I think the response of the church ultimately is to hold on to those beliefs, practices that have sustained us in the past, but obviously to understand the world we're in and see, so why is something as ancient and as apparently non-cool as communion or the Eucharist or whatever, why is that actually exactly what people in a grace-starved world need? Because it is. Why are the truths expressed in these hymns or these catechisms or creeds exactly what contemporary people are crying out for when they realize what their problem is? Because they are. But that translation process is a lot of what we think of as contextualization, and it's hugely important.
Welcome to Theology for the People. In this first episode of Season 4, I speak with pastor and author Andrew Wilson about why understanding Western culture is important for Christian theology and mission. Andrew holds a PhD from King's College London, and he serves as the teaching pastor of King's Church London. In his new book, Remaking the World, How 1776 Created the Post-Christian West, Andrew looks at seven transformational events which took place in 1776, and he shows how these events paved the way for today's post-Christian Western culture. By understanding how these events influence the way people think today, Christians can more effectively share God's truth in a post-Christian age. In our discussion, we talk about history and philosophy. We also talk about the show Lost. Andrew then explains why he thinks the modern West is characterized by what he calls Protestant paganism, and we talk about the opportunities there are for bringing the gospel to bear on the world in the West today. I hope you'll enjoy this episode. I'll be back at the end with some final words. Well, Andrew Wilson, thank you so much for being a guest on Theology for the People today.
No, it's great to be with you.
I'm excited to talk with you about your new book, which is called Remaking the World, How 1776 Created the Post-Christian West. But before we get into that, maybe you just introduce yourself to our listeners. Tell us a little bit about your background and other things that you've done.
Yeah, sure thing. I am the teaching pastor of a church in London, in Southeast London, which is where I am now. I'm part of in British terms anyway, quite a large multi-site church here in a very diverse area. And I absolutely love that. I'm married to Rachel. We've been married for 19 years. I've got three kids who are 14, 13, and 7. And I have a PhD in biblical studies from King's College London, and I write various sort of more popular level books in the main until this one anyway. We'll see how that goes down. And I've also been involved in running theological training for the movement of churches I'm part of called New Frontiers, and hosting theological conferences and speaking and writing in other places and so on. So I have a sort of half teaching pastor in a local church and half itinerant writing and stuff kind of job.
Yeah, excellent. So this is a history book, which I found really interesting, especially it's put out through Crossway, which doesn't tend to do just straight history books. But have your other books been on the topic of history or historical theology, or have they been other?
No, I studied history as an undergrad for the first 2 years of my degree in Cambridge. But no, I'm not trained as a historian. But I think in pastoral ministry, a lot of what I'm trying to do is to connect the dots for people between the world they're in now, a lot of the past in all sorts of ways, actually, and Christian theology, and understanding what that then has to say to the post-Christian world we're in, which obviously in Britain, in a city like London, we're very, very secular, very post-Christian nation. So a lot of it came out of that impulse, but it's not something I've done and majored on before, not since I was at university anyway. I do think that theology and history are much closer aligned than people often realize. And often what you call theology, and if you study a theology degree, actually a lot of what you do is history. Mm. You're reading sort of history of text and background and story of the church and historical documents and sources and all that stuff. But even so, it's definitely a departure for me. And it was a lot of fun for that reason, but quite a risk as well.
Yeah. No, so I enjoyed reading it. But tell me a little bit about what caused you to want to write this book. And again, what is the role of studying and understanding history when it comes to Christianity particularly?
So I don't think you can ever understand where you are without understanding where you've come from. And if you don't know that, you end up being like the person who walks in halfway through a conversation and starts chipping in and going, oh, well, I think it's really this. You're like, no, you've missed all this important context that means what you're saying is misguided. And I do think that at our worst, I think the church can be like that person, be a bit too opinionated without recognizing that the nuance and the context. And I just think there's a number of examples of very pressing contemporary issues on matters of, say, sexuality or matters of race, where if you wade in, you might even be right in your analysis of the biblical material, but if you blunder into conversation without understanding the historical setting in which those things make sense, then the people to whom you're speaking don't process the issues in the way that you think they should. And you end up dismissing one another or worse, or alienating them completely and making them further away from Christ than they were before. So in many ways, that sort of historical knowledge is vital to evangelism and mission, which I guess is my primary interest in it, and pastoral care. And I'm a pastor in a very diverse church where issues of race in particular are very pressing and important in our community. And I think to not have a narrative. So how has the West become what it is? And how have we come to self-critique in the way that we do? And how are ideas and material realities and economics bound up together and so on? Actually sorting some of those things out can be really helpful for people, not only in reaching their neighbors, but actually in thinking through the issues for themselves. So that's the sort of pastoral evangelistic impulse behind the book. And then once I got into the material, I found it so interesting I couldn't stop and wanted to write something much more comprehensive than I initially thought I would.
You mentioned in the opening chapter, which is called Roots, you mentioned this quote from 1984, George Orwell. I thought this was such a haunting quote where he says, "History has stopped and nothing exists now except an endless present in which the party is always right." And then he goes on to say, you know, Orwell's famous statement that those who control the past control the future. At risk of getting a little bit ahead of ourselves in our discussion, I'm curious if there are any ways that you see that at play in our world today. You know, personally, being in the United States right now, I can think of ways in which people try to reshape past narratives of, let's say, like the United States history and things like that in a way that shapes or maybe justifies actions in the present and a way forward for the future. But maybe could you just comment on that?
Yeah, I totally agree. I in many ways, I think, or something that's happened since even the book came out. I mean, the book came out on the 5th of September, and on the 7th of October, a month ago from our recording, we had the horrific events in Israel and the follow-up response in Gaza. Now, that would be a classic example of something where the narrative about what Israel should do, what Palestinians in general should do, what America should do, what Britain should do, is entirely bound up with your narrative of history. So, of course, and I mean, that might be a particularly convoluted example, but it's what we do in miniature all the time. That an issue comes up, people say, well, what should we do about this thing? And again, like the guy entering halfway through a conversation, you have to be informed by the people who've been in the conversation for longer than you. And just this morning, I'm doing some training with our staff on how to pray publicly about Israel and Gaza. And I have to go back to, you know, not just 1967, 1948, the Balfour Declaration yesterday, this, and then you're going back to the Ottomans, and then you're going back to Abraham, Isaac, and Ishmael. And so that's just how we do things all the time. Christians do it too, and we should. But I think what can happen sometimes if we're not careful is that the debates which we see as being very morally cut and dried, we don't mug up on the history. We don't understand why issues of sexual ethics or racial justice or whatever are framed in the way they are in the society we're in. And that can make us quite ignorant or quite vulnerable to another telling of that story, particularly if we simply don't know what we're talking about. And I'm not obviously attempting to incorporate all of those things in a big way into the book I've just written, but I do find that the challenge of engaging with those things without knowing your history is a really pressing one. So one of the main things I'm trying to do in the book is help frame that bigger story in such a way people go, oh, that's why that thing I'm seeing now is connected to this other thing I know. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you could give many other more American examples, but it seems to me there are plenty of them on the headlines every day.
Yeah. And so the subtitle of your book is How 1776 Created the Post-Christian West. When I first saw it, of course, immediately, having grown up in the U.S., you know, my thought was, okay, finally, a British person agrees that the most important thing that ever happened in all of history was the American Revolution. But then I got a little more into it, and it turns out that that wasn't the only thing that happened in 1776. So maybe could you just give a quick summary of like why you've given it that subtitle and what the whole idea behind the book is?
Yeah, so basically the premise of the book is that there are seven transformative events or sequences of events that took place in the late 18th century and 1776 in particular, that have formed the world that you and I live in all manner of different ways. And that the acronym I use to describe that world is that it is weirder, that it's Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic, ex-Christian, and romantic. And that is adapted from an acronym from a psychologist at Harvard called Joseph Henrich. And I've adapted the acronym to say, that's the world you live in now. And the first two chapters are really trying to say, this is, you are here on the map. This is the world you live in. It is, yes, of course, it's Western, you know that. It places a very high value on education. You use industrialized technology all the time, and that shapes your, not just your means and your wealth, but also your values in all kinds of ways. You are astonishingly rich compared to most humans who've ever lived. You are democratic, not just in your system of government, but also in the way that you think choice is paramount in the way you live your normal life on all kinds of issues, cereals, marriage partners, political parties, where to work, all those things. You are ex-Christian in the sense that the culture you're in has been very Christianized and is now trying to move out of it. And you are romantic in the sense that you've been heavily shaped by the view of the self and of art, with the romantic revolution or romanticism in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. And that's where you are. That's the world you're in. But all seven of those things are true because of things that happened in 1776. The political change on your side of the pond anyway would be very well known. But that's also the year or the decade when the economic growth of the world shot up the hockey stick. It's also the year when James Watt's steam engine was started running off, in Bloomfield Colliery in Staffordshire in Britain, and dramatically changed the amount of power human beings could make without needing to tether themselves to the wind or the water. And that was a massive thing for the next 50, and then obviously still to this day, industrial technology. It was the high point of the European Enlightenment. Immanuel Kant is drafting The Critique of Pure Reason. Edward Gibbon is writing The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. David Hume is writing his post-Christian, or his anti-Christian critique of what he calls natural religion, and then he dies. And you have the early romantics, the German Sturm und Drang in Weimar, and then you have Jean-Jacques Rousseau in Paris. And so all of these, James Cook is sailing the seven seas, if you like, going off to the South Sea Islands and connecting the world through globalization in many ways, without realizing he is. And all seven of those things are happening in the same year. In fact, sometimes on adjacent days. So Adam Smith writes The Wealth of Nations the day after James Watt's steam engine starts running. You think, this is an absolutely transformative year. And not, actually, most of the book's not about America. Uh-huh. The American Revolution is profoundly important for our political vision, but actually is not the reason why we're rich or romanticized or post-Christian, really. Uh-huh. And so what I try and do is tell all seven of those stories through the lens of one year.
So you mentioned that Joseph Henrich had come up with this acronym of WEIRD. Were the weirder, was that your personal addition to that? Was the ex-Christian?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's a bit cheaty. Mm-hmm. But I actually, when I read his book, particularly his more recent book, The Weirdest People in the World, he puts a lot of the fact that we are weird down to the fact that we are Christianized or post-Christian in my terms. And so I thought, actually, that's not the distortion of his vision at all. He doesn't admittedly talk about romanticism. But romanticism itself is, in many ways, an outgrowth of a lot of Christian values as well, as we might get on to talk about later. So that sort of, that sevenfold word, I found effectively that his WEIRD acronym is more about institutional and political and economic realities. And I wanted to broaden that to include ideological convictions, mm-hmm, and artistic ones even, which are very dearly held by Western people, but which wouldn't be included in the WEIRD. Mm-hmm. So I lengthened it by two to give us those two stories as well.
I like the addition of the romantic part. It reminded me, I read earlier this year, I read Carl Truman's stuff on the triumph, yeah, of the, how does he call it? The triumph of the...
The rise and triumph of the modern self.
That's it. Yeah. And he talks a ton about romanticism. And I didn't realize until I read that just how influential romanticism has been. I want to ask you about that more too. On a bigger picture, I want to say that one of the things I really appreciate about your book is that I do love reading history, but most of the time, history books don't end with a, well, because of that, therefore this. And you do end your book with saying, now here are the opportunities for the Christian church in this day and age from a missiological perspective and a discipleship perspective. I thought that was really helpful. And we'll dial in on some of that in a minute. But let me ask you this next question. You mentioned in your acronym the term ex-Christian, and please explain that. Why do you choose that instead of post-Christian? And is there a difference?
I'm afraid there's not a good explanation for that at all. It's because it starts with an E.
Yeah.
Post-Christian is actually a term I would use more often, and it's the term in the subtitle. But I wanted the acronym to work, and I actually find that there is, as Henrik showed by using the word weird, there is some power in saying you are weird or you are weirder. Mm-hmm. It's an arresting acronym because it makes the individual who's Western go, huh, there's maybe a billion of us alive today who think like this, but about 7 billion of us who think like that and do not share all of these, and in some cases, almost any of these convictions about certain things. So that's all that was, I'm afraid. And I, obviously what I mean by that is not that everyone in the past used to be Christian and now no one is. That's clearly not true. You and I are here, and if you study the Middle Ages, you'll realize no, there's plenty of people there who were not really following Jesus either. But that to say that the institutions, the assumptions, the moral vision of Christianity was so baked into what we now think of as Western society for so many generations that it can almost be taken for granted. And now people are moving beyond, you know, Mark Thayer's term, we want the kingdom without a king. Or the language I've sometimes used is we are post-Christian in the same sense that we're post-industrial, which is people say, oh, here's a post-industrial area of New York City, whatever. And what they mean is not no one there uses electricity. What they mean is industrialization is so secure that we've been able to move beyond it and create urban gardens with wood-burning stoves and everyone's vegan. Mm-hmm. And in other words, we're hyper-industrialized. We're so industrialized that we can bake in the results of industrialization and not need them. And I'm saying in that sense, the world is post-Christian in an analogous way, which is to say that the assumptions of Christianity about concern for the weak or compassion or love being the chiefest virtue, you know, the Beatles, all you need is love, that those kind of things, people say them as a way of attacking Christianity and don't realize that those assumptions are themselves profoundly Christian in their shape. And it's in that sense we're post-Christian. We said, well, we've got all of these things. Everyone knows human rights are a thing. So why do we need Jesus? Mm. And so we'll move beyond it. And of course, the reason human rights are a thing is because of Christian convictions about human dignity. And who knows how long they will remain if you abandon Christianity and all of its works. And that is a question I dip into briefly in the book. But that's what I mean by post-Christian, not that it's a sort of a wholesale abandonment of faith, but that the results of Christian faith are so secure in society that people feel free to move beyond.
Mm. Now, in your chapter on the Enlightenment, I thought this was really interesting. You say that there were two main factors which shaped this period, and you say they were Protestantism and paganism. And you go so far as to claim that the Enlightenment thinkers were actually primarily pagan. So could you speak to that? And do you think that affects
us? Do you know what? I've done a bunch of these conversations and no one has picked up on it. So I'm really glad you have. So this is an idea that comes from the great intellectual historian, Peter Gay, who wrote his 2-volume work on the Enlightenment and talked about, and entitled them, The Rise of Modern Paganism. And he did that not because he was saying that, you know, David Hume and Immanuel Kant and so on, Voltaire and Diderot are all dancing around the maple, worshipping phallic symbols or whatever it is, but he meant that they located they were heavily influenced by the Greek and Roman philosophers and poets and playwrights, and they located the ultimacy or transcendence or whatever within this world rather than beyond. And I really like that. It's just so simple. Peter Jones talks about oneism and twoism. He says oneism is everything is part of this, of the world that we see and the material world. And twoism is there are two types of things. There are the things in this world and there's the creator beyond it. And Christians, in that sense, are Jews, are twoists. And so, to be fair, are Muslims. But modern pagans and the Enlightenment thinkers are oneists in that sense. So that's, Peter Gay means something a little bit like that. He said the Enlightenment was really a discovery of the ancient pagan writings and their metaphysics, as well as their love of literature and inquiry and drama and so on. And then what they did, they were self-consciously, the Enlighteners, were trying to go back behind the Christian revolution to the pagans that the ancient world was full of before Christianity came along. And some of them very explicitly, Edward Gibbon is, you know, you read the Decline, many won't have, but the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire is very clearly a celebration of ancient paganism. And really, the baddies are Christians for coming along and destroying it all with their intolerant commitment to worship one God, not lots of gods. And now we destroyed this beautiful, nary, you know, pagan world we had before. And so this is not an idea that's new to me. The idea that Enlightenment thought, and actually much European and Western thought and American thought even today would be very pagan in that sense. But what I've done in the book that I think is not quite unique to me, but the distinctive contribution, I hope, is to mix paganism with Protestantism and say those two influences are really what's made the modern West what it is from an intellectual, spiritual perspective. And I think that comes through in high works of history and philosophy like Hume and Gibbon, but it also comes through in very ordinary, everyday ways, like the Declaration of Independence or the way that people in your town put up posters on their Starbucks notice board. I think they reflect a fusion of Protestant moral conviction and fervor with a very pagan vision of spirituality and metaphysics. And that confusion is what makes us who we are.
Does some of that Protestantism, I noticed on page 156, I thought this was really interesting. You mentioned, along with the coffee shop notice board, you say that there's this kind of spiritual options are hugely diverse, right? There are all these different options of spiritual practices and experiences with a very narrow range of dogmatic commitments. So which part of that do you think is Protestantism? Does that come into the matter of like choice based on convictions? Is that where that?
So I use the example, as many have, of course, that the famous yard sign, which says, in this house, we believe Black Lives Matter, kindness is everything, love is love, women's rights are human rights, and so on. All of those statements, of course, taken as they stand, are true and very Christian. I know they have policy implications that I wouldn't always share, but they're true as they stand. But even the fact that, so the content is Christian and Protestant, but not only that, but the form is profoundly Protestant. In this house, we believe, as in, I'm affirming a creed. This is my doctrine. I am, in a sense, being justified by faith or what I claim to believe or assert. Yeah, actually, you've got no access to me in the social media world. You've got no access to whether or not I do anything about any of those things. Mm. In fact, my Christian neighbor might give financially far more to issues of racial justice or fighting modern slavery than the person with the yard sign in their garden. But you can't appraise them. All you can see is what I say I believe. And that is, of course, a very Protestant idea. So we are Protestant in that sense. The dogmatic convictions, even tearing down of statues, is a very Protestant habit. And again, listeners will no doubt have different takes on whether or not you should ever do that, and if so, why. But that's a very Protestant habit. The Reformation happened, and instantly everyone's stripping altars, tearing down statues. And in the case of people like Voltaire, who was, of course, from this period, throwing red paint all over him, David Hume getting thrown, he's been cancelled and his name's been taken off buildings in Edinburgh. Often, by the way, with very, I would say, very good reasons. There's a very dark history there to tell. But the point is, of course, that's a very Protestant way of responding to a person with a complex past. And so we, by calling people effectively problematic, we will take away their images from the public square. Well, that's what Protestants do. Mm. So it's very interesting. Iconoclasm is a very Protestant thing. So we are, in that sense, very dogmatic and quite, like the early Protestants, actually, quite intolerant of some of that imagery and quite strong. I'm very Protestant, by the way, clear, I'm a pastor in a Reformed charismatic church, so I'm totally Protestant. But I also know that is what we do, and that's what I think you should do with images of God in worship services. But it's interesting to see how much that is the response of the contemporary West in the last few years to individuals in your country and mine. Hmm. That's very Protestant. But meanwhile, our spirituality is very open and very vague and very mushy and very, believe whatever works for you. And of course, the gods might look like this. There might not be any gods. There might be one, but I'm sure whatever you like. And it's very floaty and mixed with this very strident, dogmatic set of moral convictions. And it's that fusion that I call Protestant paganism.
Yeah, and I mean, even that phrase, right, in this house we believe, kind of, in a way, kind of throws you back to Martin Luther, like, here I stand, I can do no other.
Yeah.
So help me
God. Yeah, it really does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now I'm just in my mind thinking through, well, what about those parts of the Western world that have Catholic roots as opposed to Protestant roots? I mean, I think that probably a case could be made that the Protestant Reformation has affected those areas probably more than you might assume, just because they are primarily still Roman Catholic. Any thoughts on that? Like, what about, I'm thinking like Ireland, Mexico, Spain, places like that.
Yeah, I agree. So the bit of the story that I don't do enough justice to in my book is the impact of the French Revolution, which obviously comes 13 years later after the American Revolution. And so I think Protestantism is doing its work not only through formally Protestant nation, but also through the process of secularization, which is obviously not something that Protestant pastors like me would generally go, hey, this is one of our great contributions to the world. But in that sense, the French Revolution, I mean, this is, Voltaire is explicitly saying this at the time, saying basically Luther and Calvin reformed the church and got rid of all of this mumbo jumbo nonsense, which we don't need. I'm just saying you need to go a bit step further and get rid of the trappings of Christianity generally and leave us just with a God of love. That's what we should do. And Voltaire's very explicitly saying, let's do this as effectively hyper-Protestants. And so, and that's of course what then happens in France. And they really do, they go absolutely bananas to the point they strip France not only of the trappings of Christianity, but of God altogether, run around chopping everybody's heads off for a few years and then go, hang on a second, that's a bit excessive. And then they pare it back. But what you have now in France is of course a very, and ever since really, is a quite a sort of generic formal Christianity in the public square running alongside a population that's still very confessionally Catholic. And something a bit similar to that in my understanding of it, and it's not something on which I'm an expert, is becomes true to a greater or lesser degree in other large Catholic majority countries in Europe in the course of the 19th century, Spain, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Poland, and various. So I think there is still a parallel there. And I agree, some of that is the influence of Protestantism directly, but some of it is the Protestant impulse within the Catholic Church, which ends up shaping the public square and the way government and public thought and philosophy runs in those nations, particularly France, which is the most influential of those nations over the course of the next 150 years. In fact, I would say in many ways probably still is, but certainly was until the 1960s or 70s.
Well, that's a great point about the Protestant impulse. I mean, just remembering that the Protestantism as a movement, I mean, birthed out of the milieu of the Catholic Church. I mean, so that's interesting. Well, so could you describe now how Romanticism shapes the Western world today? And what do you think it means for Christianity, for discipleship, for evangelism?
So Romanticism is incredibly hard to define. So I don't really even try in the book or try and give 8 words that summarize what I think it means. But I think in outline, if you went back to the philosophers, artists, musicians, poets of the late 18th century and compared them with people writing 50 or 100 years before them, you would see a dramatic change in the way that people, the way the Romantics relative to their predecessors spoke about the who I am, what really matters about me, where the true me is to be found. And you would find in the work of, I particularly focus on Rousseau because he's writing his Reveries of a Solitary Walker in 1776. And he just says, I am going to do this. I'm going to look into my own soul. I'm going to find out what's there. And I'm going to spill it out into the world. And I'm going to contemplate my, he uses words like sincerity or veracity de coeur, or truthfulness of heart, or sincerity de coeur and veracity. These ideas of authenticity and truthfulness and the inner my truth, you might say. I mean, I'm not quite putting Rousseau and Oprah alongside each other, but that's actually what is being reflected when people talk of telling my truth or being authentic to your true self. And we, to be honest, all of us, almost no matter how Christian we are, will still know what people mean by that and might well use that language ourselves. And that goes back really to a handful of figures in the late 18th century who begin to talk that way about themselves, which you mentioned Carl Truman. He's done this sort of story in some detail, but also the way that people present the relationship between the self and the world and God in art, music, literature. And so those stories, most people in my church or my city are not reading Rousseau, but they are reading or watching films or works of art or pieces of music that have been heavily shaped by that vision of what is true humanity and where real life is to be found and how I'm relate to the world and to God and spirit and where the true me is and what I should do about that. That the true me is internal, and that sort of inwardness and interiority that characterizes the Romantics then gets translated quickly into poetry with the English Romantics and the Germans. And then it comes through very, you know, the Germans specifically comes through in plays very early, mid-1770s, 80s, with people like Schiller and Goethe. And then it gets brought out in, you know, great music, which is often what a lot of people would know now from Beethoven onwards, this sort of romantic expression of the kind of grandeur of the human soul, as opposed to these sort of rules and structures that we've inherited from you know, the our predecessors. And so this kind of idea of the individual rebelling against this very ordered, overwhelming system, expressing their true self from within and saying, you've got to take me as I am. Goethe says, I return into myself and find a world. Look how interesting I am. It's, and what's the line from Herder where he even says you have to be, at one point he says you have to be true to yourself, which now sounds like it's something from Frozen or Toy Story. But at the time, it was quite a novel idea. And you and I hear it now and we go, even as Christians, you'd go, yeah, well, obviously that's what people would say. But in the 1770s, it was very novel. And it comes back to these sort of, mainly German and occasionally French and then English thinkers and writers and poets, most of them very young, who are exploring new ideas. And now they've become totally taken for granted in Western culture.
Yeah, there's a line from Rousseau too, where he says, I read it in your book, he says something like, I may not be like the best person, but at least I'm unique. And that's what makes me.
Yes.
And I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, he does. And he's always talking about himself. Yeah. He writes multiple books about himself because he's just so interested in what he finds in his soul. And Western people, that the what you, if you're being harsh, the narcissism of modern Westerners that we all care, we were obsessed with ourselves and who we are. Even I make this quip at the beginning when I'm describing weirder people. One of the I make about 100 generalizations about everyone reading it, and one of them is you've taken at least one personality test. Now I've taken probably 4 or 5 personality tests, but the fact that I have is, I mean, that would have been incomprehensible to John Owen or John Calvin or Thomas. Can you imagine Thomas Aquinas doing a personality test? But of course, modern people do because they say what's in here is what really matters. Yeah. I've got to find it out and then stick it out into the world.
Okay, so this is a bit of an aside, but did you ever watch Lost?
I did. I watched the first 2 seasons and then concluded that the writers didn't know what they were doing in David.
I think you were right about that, and it proved itself in the end. But, you know, there was one really fascinating part about Lost that I think went over some people's heads, and that was that I think in a way they weren't sure what they wanted to do with it, but they had this idea that they teased out a bit. And that was that they named one of their characters John Locke and they named another character Rousseau. And then they even had episodes, which like if you had read a little philosophy, you would notice them immediately, like Tabula Rasa. And they had one called like Man of Science, Man of Faith. And it was about John Locke. And if you followed the John Locke character's storyline, I mean, it was, you know, trying to track with the main lines of thinking that John Locke had put forth. But that one that Rousseau was particularly fascinating to me is like Rousseau was this person who had sought to go back into nature and cut off a connection with society because the concept was that society is what corrupts an individual. And so that concept was kind of like brought into and lived out in this TV show, you know, for better or for worse.
I feel awful for not noticing that. So it was John Locke I picked up straight away, but I didn't notice there was a character called Rousseau in Lost.
Yeah.
I almost feel like rewatching it now, but I feel like it will annoy me enough not to.
I think it came about in like maybe 4. I don't remember exactly, but it's this woman who has cut herself off from society and gone into nature in order to, you know.
A proper Rousseau reconstruction.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I don't think they ever did anything with it beyond being like, hey, this is cool. But yeah. Okay, so for you as a pastor, as a discipler, as an evangelist, church planter, how does romanticism shape the way that you do ministry?
So first, I'm not a church planter. I'm a pastor in a quite a large established church, but I definitely want to help people who do plant churches with this stuff. I mean, romanticism is, in a way, it's the waters I swim in, and it's partly part of the purpose of that section of the book is to help people become aware of the fact that that is the way people think and that serving them and understanding them is going to involve some reckoning with it. I think the best way I could summarize the response I want to make as a pastor or evangelist or whatever in that setting is actually, believe it or not, from somebody who's not a Christian at all, but a quote at the end of that chapter from a novel by Donna Tartt, called The Goldfinch, which is about 10 years old now, won loads of awards, sold loads of copies, and it's a beautiful romantic novel in many ways, a classic story about a young man who, you know, gets caught up in a stolen painting and then in the underground criminal gangs and, you know, ends up going on a journey of discovery. And so it's a classic sort of modern novel. But towards the very end of the book, he is ruminating on his life and is doing quite a Rousseau-ish kind of musing on the world and history and life and everything he's learned. And he has this wonderful moment where he says, how do you know what's right for you? I mean, everyone knows the answer, Mr. Rogers and Disney movies, and they all say, follow your heart. But the question I have, which I really want someone to answer, is, but what happens if your heart can't be trusted? What happens if your heart leads you to make terrible choices? And actually, in some way, I don't quote Donatelle very often in preaching, but that turning of its head, I mean, she's written a novel that's 800 pages long, and for 750, it's come out like a pretty straight romantic novel, but she poses the problem at the heart of the romantic account of reality, which is, of course, you can follow your heart into all this sort of stuff. But what if it doesn't end like Disney movies do, and it ends more like real life normally does, which is the people who follow their heart make a lot of bad choices because their heart is not a reliable guide to reality? What happens if the surge of emotion you feel is not the best guide to the way to lead a wholesome life? What if happens even if what your soul wants isn't the right thing for your soul? What if your soul doesn't even desire the best things, which is a more Augustinian question? How do you know that what you love or want is the best thing for you? And she just raises that question so beautifully. So that's often what I'm trying to do with romanticism, I think, is slightly turn it on its head and say, this is the plot of many stories, because we'd love to believe that those desires we have will ultimately be fulfilled and we live happily ever after. But as soon as we're no longer children, we know that those desires are more, at best, more morally ambiguous than, and sometimes downright destructive. So what are we going to do when that happens? And what other source of guide, of wisdom and insight might we need beyond simply our own impulses? Mm-hmm. Which is a question I'd love to put to Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and a question that we have to continue to put in this world. So, and obviously, as we're preachers, I am drawing in biblical revelation to try and address or raise that question. But I think it's vital to help people in a very romanticized culture ask that massive question, which is, how do I know that this is actually going to be good for me in the end?
Mm. Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Now, just wrapping up, just getting to the conclusion of your book, you talk about opportunities for the church in this weirder world that we live in. So you say that our culture in the West, you point out, it's not nearly as post-Christian as people would tend to think. I think you've kind of explained what you meant by that, but then you say that one of the opportunities we have in this weirder world to be the church and to carry out the mission of God is proclaiming the message of grace and leading people into true freedom. And I love this quote. It's page 279. You said, anyone who thinks justification by works is an exclusively religious phenomenon just needs to spend a few minutes on Twitter. So I was hoping maybe you could expound on that for a moment.
Yeah. The case I make, justification by faith and not by works of the law, is always a core Christian idea. Whether the church has always seen it as clearly in every generation is another matter, but it's always been called right out to Paul. And I would say before, back to Habakkuk, back to Genesis in many ways. But I think there are things in different generations, there are different elements of the society we're in and the waters we swim in that make us particularly prone to the message of grace. Now, in Luther's day, in the Reformation, that was, you know, there was, you know, religious claptrap taken over, and indulgences really was the thing that made people awake and say, this cannot be the way we approach God. And they were open to that message when it came very clearly. And that had a massive impact on Europe and the church. Nowadays, people are not buying indulgences, and people are not in the same way anyway. And people are not concerned with the question. People in my city are not walking around daily on their way to the bus stop going, how do I please an angry God? That's not their problem. But what they are living with is a bunch of issues like how you find status in the modern world, how you find identity in the modern world, what you do with your privilege to the extent that you have it, all of which can lead Western people, weirder people, to seek to justify themselves by works in the sense of how do I warrant the good things that have happened to me? How do I discharge my obligations to my fellow humans or to the natural world or whatever? These are a big part of the questions people ask. And I think from Colorado, and I imagine they're a big issue there as well. And people are living daily with a sense of, how do I define my identity? Like 200 years ago, my identity, or 1,000 years ago, my identity was, this is my father, this is my mother, this is my clan, this is my family, this is my village, this is my trade, and this is my religion. It's all given to me. But in the modern world, you can be anything you want. Family doesn't really matter. You can choose your own religion, choose where you want to live, what you want to do. So how do you carve out space for yourself? And of course, what people do is they justify themselves by works. They say, this is how I will have achieved this or that. I will have merited, in that sense, the attention or the recognition of my fellow humans. And that's what means I'm able to stand with some degree of self-respect in this world, in the same status. So it's that kind of complex of issues that I think makes modern people need grace. They say, you need to rest in the work of somebody else. You are exhausted of trying to justify yourself by works, but they're not religious observant indulgence purchasing works. They're works of the modern secular man with an almost infinite array of possibilities, but it's work nonetheless. And you need the grace of God in Christ to soothe you and restore you and lead you in the way that is restful for your soul, because you're never going to feel like you've done enough. And I pick up that line at the very end of Hamilton. Well, ironically, Eliza Hamilton, who's a Christian woman and almost certainly would not have said this, says, have I done enough? Like, will they tell my story? But that's the line I draw on and say, I don't think that's what she thinks as a real person, but it's what the writer of the musical and many of the audience think. Have I done enough? What if Alexander Hamilton did that and then died, what have I done? And that question, of course, leads us to the grace of God in Christ, where the question is not, what have you done, but what's he done?
Yeah, that's really good. That's certainly something that, you know, I have thought about, and I know that other people do. You know, will someone write my story? These kinds of things, and just having to produce something is very exhausting. So, yeah, that's excellent. So, last question for you is this: one of the things you asked at the end of the book, you kind of finish with this big question, which is, does the church need a radical change of approach to adjust to an unprecedented world, or do we need a renewed commitment to the doctrines, practices, and experiences that have sustained the church in the past? And then you say that you lean towards the latter. But one of the things that I found really interesting is that you said that in a weirder world, people tend to be obsessed with winning, and they hate the idea of losing. So when they see that the church, perhaps in the, you know, weirder world, the Western world, is being pushed to the margins, they tend to have a, you know, panic and try to scramble to find new methods. So I just love to hear you talk about that for a minute and what you think is the right approach that we should be taking.
Yeah, but that's a huge question. And in many ways, I'm nodding my head in various directions at the end of that book, rather than trying to do a whole, because I think there's lots of books to be written and are being written about that is a question. But you're right. I think the desire for a more familiar word than winning would be success. A desire for immediate success in the church often means that people will make pragmatically, apparently good moves that in the long run are destructive for discipleship, and that is something that, you know, again, pastor of a multi-site church, and so I'm not against big church at all. I live with these dynamics every day. But I think that it can make us rush into pragmatically appealing solutions that look like they're going to get us back on the winning team. And that can be true of all sorts of things, from the way we preach, through our worship, or our corporate gatherings, to what we do and do not decide to value, to the amount of time we give people to grow, and the way we do evangelism, and the way we even just what we count, what we measure, what we think success looks like. Does it mean the number of Christians who we can attract to our building, from what distance? You think, that's not a very good measure of spiritual maturity. So I think that is a danger that I think I'm aware of doing what I do. And I think, yes, I am more on the side of what the church has always done is probably mostly what we need. Of course, you have to contextualize it and translate it into a modern setting. But I don't think we need a complete reinvention of approach. I think the thing about winning is probably more challenging in your nation than mine, because in my nation, it's obvious and has been for quite a few decades now that the church does not have anything like the level of influence and voice that she once did. And if anything, our challenge is being noticed, is being heard. Whereas in your nation, widespread Christian influence is still recent enough that people can feel very angry about having lost it. And that gets expressed in all kinds of ways in the public square. So I think that the degree of that challenge will vary according to the nation. And of course, in my nation, it's probably more of a risk than it would be in a nation like France, where it's probably even further ago in the past and that sort of thing. So I think there's a lot more we could say about it. But I think the response of the church, ultimately, I do think, is to hold on to those beliefs, practices that have sustained us in the past, but obviously to understand the world we're in and see, so why is that? Why is something as ancient and as apparently non-cool as communion or the Eucharist or whatever. Why is that actually exactly what people in a grace-starved world need? Because it is. Mm. Why are the truths expressed in these hymns or these catechisms or creeds exactly what contemporary people are crying out for when they realize what their problem is? Because they are. But that translation process is a lot of what we think of as contextualization, and it's hugely important. But I think that's less about changing those things as it is about presenting them to a modern world in a way that they can understand them.
Well, thank you so much, Andrew. Where can people find out, where can they connect with you online, find your other writings or sermons, things like that?
Well, it's very kind of you to ask. I'm Alton. So the platform I'm most active on is Twitter, or the artist formerly known as Twitter, yeah. AJW Theology. I also have a blog, thinktheology.co.uk, which I posted on a lot more 5 years ago, but I still do, yeah, relatively regularly. I'm the teaching pastor at King's Church London, so that's where I'm preaching, almost all of my preaching is these days. I ran a column, Christianity Today, right, for the Coalition place in the world. So, yeah, thank you for asking.
Yeah, excellent. Thanks so much for your time today, Andrew.
Oh, it's great to talk.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Theology for the People. New episodes will be released every Wednesday, so make sure to subscribe to the podcast on whatever app you use to listen to podcasts. And that way, new episodes will be delivered right to your device as soon as they come out. In our next episode, I'll be speaking with Dr. Peter J. Williams from Tyndale House. And we'll be talking about the surprising genius of Jesus and how there's way more to the parable of the prodigal son than most readers ever realize. Theology for the People is a listener-supported program. If you have enjoyed or been encouraged by this content, please consider sharing it with others and leaving a written review on either the Apple Podcast or Spotify apps. If you'd like to support this podcast financially, there's a link in the show notes where you can make a donation to support the show. Until next time, thanks for listening, and God bless you.